Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hip-hop is a product of black people. It's a product of black song and celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents...
Hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop store.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny...
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at ajc.com/hip-hop.
You're listening to the Season 5 reboot of Breakdown, The MacGyver Murder Case, a podcast of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. For additional information, photos, videos, and documents relating to the MacGyver prosecution, please go to ajcbreakdown.com. Join our Breakdown Facebook group for continuing conversations about the case. And follow us on Twitter at ajcbreakdown and at ajccourts.
Previously on Breakdown...
He shakes up that bottle with muddy water and it gets really muddy, and then he puts it on the jury rail, and at the end of his hour closing argument, all the mud has settled and it's all clear.
Rather than send jurors back with a blindfold over one eye because they only got to see what the lawyers thought they should see, why not lift that blindfold?
I dance on the table because dancing is my life, and I just wanted to see everybody to see my moves.
In a case defined by bombshells, the prosecution has detonated a few more, just days before trial. Here's the first one. Since we last talked, the state filed a motion saying it has evidence that Tex tried to bribe someone to make his case go away. The state has yet to provide details of the allegation. It surely will. What it does say is that the alleged offenses occurred between January and April of last year, and that its witness is Jeff Dickerson. Now, I know Jeff Dickerson. He was once an editorial writer for the Atlanta Journal. More recently, he's been a political and PR consultant, and one of his clients early last year was, yes, of course, Tex MacIver. Here's the next bombshell from the state. The prosecution submitted its witness list last week. It contains 173 people. Now, prosecutors often dump a giant witness list on the defense as a tactic. The state might have no intention of calling all the witnesses. But the defense has to go and investigate every one of them or risk being caught unprepared when a given witness takes the stand. In this case, however, the state put the notation, "will call," next to more than 90 of the witnesses. Will call. That means this trial could last until season 17 of Breakdown. Or at least until April. We'll see. As you'll remember, Tex didn't call 911. He opted instead to transport Diane to Emory University Hospital 4.5 miles away. Exactly the thing that wouldn't have happened if Tex had called 911. Here's prosecutor Clint Rucker from last week's hearing. He quotes Dr. Susan Hardy, who tried to save Diane's life at Emory.
Had she gone to Grady, she had a great chance to survive.
If Tex had called 911, paramedics would have arrived within minutes and sped toward Grady Memorial Hospital, a level one trauma center.
They would have been scrubbed, prepped, ready to take her immediately into the operating room and not have her lay on a gurney at Emory University for the better part of almost 40 minutes. 40 minutes before they could do anything.
The defense argues that Tex couldn't have known all that. He was panicked. He was trying to save his wife. He took her to the hospital he knew best. And in truth, Emory has an excellent reputation in Atlanta and beyond. But not, as I've now learned, for treating gunshot wounds. I'm Bill Rankin, legal affairs writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. If you like this podcast and want to support journalism like this, please think about subscribing to the AJC. Go to myajc.com/subscribe. Well, it looks as if this case is really going to trial, barring some last-minute plea deal. As you'll recall, Clint Rucker told us that's not his style. I'm sorry. I really love this piece of audio.
I think everybody in this room knows that pretty much taking pleas on murder cases, that's not what I do. I go to trial on cases. And I fully expect to go to trial on this one.
Actually, I love it so much that I've begun to think of Rucker this way. Clint.
I go to trial.
Rucker. Last week, we promised you we'd talk trial strategy for both the prosecution and the defense in the Tex McIver murder case. During a four-hour hearing on Wednesday, days before trial, the prosecution handed us a big preview of what seems like a truly risky trial strategy. Each side faces a giant problem of its own in this trial. For the prosecution, it's the question of the motive for murder. The law doesn't require evidence of motive. It only requires evidence of a murder. But juries like a good solid motive. Why did he do it? Rucker told the court that he's going with the secret second will theory. That is, Diane McIver wrote a new will that would have cost Tex dearly. Rucker said, and I quote, "Our position is there was a new will and that it had been secreted from the state. Much of our investigation has been a pursuit to locate it." Now, that's the sort of motive that might lead a jury to believe Diane's death was no accident. But the fly here is so big you can't see the ointment. Rucker doesn't have a copy of the will. In effect, he only thinks there was a second will, and what the prosecutor thinks isn't evidence. Kind of gives a new meaning to where there's a will, there's a way. The giant problem for the defense? In a word, Tex. McIver did some certifiably crazy things after the shooting. You remember, auctioning off Diane's wardrobe and jewelry after she died, telling Danny Joe the night of the shooting to tell the cops she wasn't there, leaning on friends and recorded phone calls from the jail, keeping a pistol in his sock drawer after the judge had told him, "No guns in your house." So, let's break it down, because you know what this podcast is called. We'll take the prosecution strategy first. One of the state's strongest pieces of evidence is that Tex pulled the trigger. He shot and killed his wife. Simple as that. Listen to Prosecutor Clint Rucker at a bond revocation hearing last year. This was about the gun in the sock drawer. Tex had to go back to jail for that one. Rucker stated the prosecution's case rather concisely during that hearing.
We know that the contention, this is what Mr. Hill just said, it's an accident. Terrible accident. The gun that killed Diane McIver, it just went off. Accidentally. Just boom. It's a bunch of malarkey. Guns don't just go off. You gotta pull the trigger.
Well, guns do just go off. But you really can't argue that every trigger pull, every time, everywhere, is intentional. According to the CDC, accidental shootings killed 495 people in 2016. Here's a quick and depressing quiz. What is the leading cause of firearm deaths? A. Homicide. B. Suicide. C. Hunting accidents. Yeah, it's B. Suicides. Of the 38,658 total deaths by firearms, 22,938 were suicides. That's nearly 60%. 14,415 were homicides. And this fatal shooting was committed by a guy who knew his way around a gun. In fact, the prosecution will assert Tex was obsessed with guns. Tex liked guns so much that there's almost no way he could have accidentally shot his wife in the manner he described, the state will say.
I'm going to tell you, Judge, what you can infer from some of the evidence. It's because he is infatuated with guns. He loves guns.
And I suspect this will come up over and over and over again. During the hearing last week, Harvey cited the prosecution's plan to bring all of Texas handguns and long guns into the courtroom, kind of an awesome display of firepower. The pile of weapons would be prejudicial, Harvey said, adding that photos would suffice. Remember when I told you about Bruce Harvey's table dance during the Gold Club trial? The judge apparently couldn't resist saying,
"You don't want a pointless theatrical display, like getting up on the table and dancing."
That was pointless. The display of the firearms would be pointless because what does it show that a picture couldn't show?
Tex's relationships with guns started when he was a kid. MacIver said his cousins taught him how to shoot using short, single-shot shotguns. Say that five times really fast. He also trained with weapons in the Air Force. Over the years, MacIver began to collect handguns and long guns. He kept most of them at his ranch near Lake Oconee. At the time MacIver was first charged, Putnam County Sheriff Howard Sills, a longtime friend of the MacIvers, agreed to remove all the guns from Tex's ranch house.
If I remember right, it was like 35 or something like that. It was like 10 handguns and like 25 long guns of some sort, most of which were all lever action rifles. I mean, the man got a thing for a lever action rifle, which I guess is all part of the cowboy thing and the Texas thing, yeah. And I know that may sound like a lot of guns. There's not a lot of guns for around here.
Don't forget, Tex was on the American Bar Association's Standing Committee on Gun Violence. Among its goals, the prevention of firearm-related injuries and deaths. Tex was an odd pick for that position, given his checkered history with guns. There was that 1990 shooting episode when Tex got mad at a carload of teenagers on the street for drinking beers and making noise. Tex fired his gun into the air, the kids started driving away, and Tex fired twice at the car. Fortunately, no one was hit. We have audio from the preliminary hearing in that case in which Tex was charged with 3 counts of aggravated assault. Here's one of the teenagers testifying at that hearing.
I saw that it was a handgun, it was a pistol.
It must have hit as we were going by, bang, it hit at an angle, slid in, and it kind of went in there. I felt the report of that gun, and I know what the report off of the gun feels like. It's a shockwave. You just feel it, and I felt it. I felt it. You know, it felt like someone was slamming something on my door. But I've shot a rifle before, and I've shot pistols before, and I know what it feels like.
On the night Diane was shot at the hospital, MacIver was joined by his old friend and attorney, Steve Maples. Maples was the lawyer representing MacIver in that long-ago hearing. Maples was trying to show that not all the shots hit the car and that, hey, the car wasn't badly damaged in any case. This brought a rebuke from the judge.
The state's theory of the case is if a person by the name of Tex MacIver shot 2 shots at a moving car. Now, it's irrelevant whether bullets hit the car or not. If he shot it at the car with occupants in the car, that's an aggravated assault.
Tex somehow skated on that case by agreeing to pay for the damage to the car. The case was dismissed under circumstances that, 28 years later, aren't entirely clear. Of course, the prosecution thinks this is important evidence in the murder trial. It shows Tex's propensity to pull the trigger. And something else. Tex initially lied to the police in that episode, telling them he didn't fire his gun. In a hearing last year, Rucker said that shows that MacIver is willing to lie to the law to protect himself. And of course, the defense thinks there should be no mention of this incident because it has no similarity to the shooting of Diane. In other words, the 1990 shooting was no accident, but the shooting of Diane was, according to the defense. A few weeks ago, Judge McBurney ruled that the jury would be able to hear about the 1990 incident. Last week, however, the judge said he had reconsidered and would decide during the trial whether to let it in. McBurney said the same thing about the buzzard. The buzzard? So, there was the time when a buzzard had the temerity to land on a deck railing at the MacIver's Buckhead condo. Tex tried to blow it off its perch. This came out during a hearing last year. Janie Calhoun, a neighbor of the MacIvers at the Buckhead condo, testified that 4 or 5 years ago, a buzzard flew onto her deck and she couldn't get it to fly away. The next afternoon, she was over at the MacIvers and looked out onto their deck and saw the same buzzard sitting there. Well, we can scare it, Tex said, according to Calhoun. Tex went and got a gun, either a real pistol or a BB pistol, Calhoun said, and he fired at the buzzard through an open door. Didn't hit the buzzard, but it flew away, she said. This caught Judge McBurney's attention, and mine, and yours. He asked Calhoun if Tex really fired the gun out an open door. Yes, Calhoun said, but there are woods out there and a big oak tree. Au contraire, said the judge. Someone might have been walking around down there. Bullets don't float, he said. At some point, they come down. All this seems mildly ironic, given what Tex told us in an interview last year. He said he knows the fundamentals of gun safety.
Every gun's loaded until you unload it, personally, regardless of what somebody tells you.
In researching the MacIver case, we interviewed the owner of a local gun range. Tom Dietz runs Sharpshooters USA in Roswell, Georgia, a gun store and shooting range. We also spoke that day with Matt Millier, then an employee of Sharpshooters. The two told us the gun may have been cocked when Diane handed it to Tex, or Tex may have cocked it afterward. Or perhaps the gun wasn't cocked at all.
There's not an external safety. The safety is the fact that it's a 12-pound trigger pull. Internally, this gun, you could drop it and throw it and do anything you want. Tie the grip and drive it down the road, the gun's not going to go off.
I've carried a firearm as a civilian for about a decade, mm-hmm. basically every day, and before that, 6 years in the Navy. And I have never had a firearm that I was carrying just go off.
The relative ease or difficulty of firing the Smith & Wesson 38 is critical to the MacIver case. More on that in a minute. But accidental discharges of guns are not all that rare.
I've had accidental discharges of guns. Every cop I know has had accidental discharges of guns. Guns usually do not malfunction. Every accidental discharge I had was due to carelessness on my part.
That's Sheriff Howard Sills.
It's nothing to make light of. It's dangerous. It's a gun. And that's why, growing up, it's pounded into your head. But every second, as you're learning how to handle a gun as a child, this thing will kill you or kill somebody else.
Dietz and Millier told us there are four fundamental rules of gun safety. Let's see how many Tex violated. It's actually pretty amazing for a gun maven, assuming this was an accident.
The four fundamental rules of firearm safety, one of them is to never point your weapon at something you're not willing to destroy or kill. Mm-hmm. And so if he's sitting here and he's got his firearm sitting on his lap like this and his wife's in the seat in front of him, he is pointing a firearm at his wife mm-hmm. that he's not intending to kill. So he's violating a rule of firearm mm-hmm. safety there.
Of course, prosecutors say he was intending to kill Diane.
A rule that we used to use, that they used to teach when I was in the military was, again, you don't pull your gun until you're ready to shoot it.
Right.
So that's another one that he broke. And then, of course, having his finger on the trigger is another one that he broke. So those, he was negligent about.
And don't go to sleep with a loaded gun in your hand? Duh. We also spoke with a gun expert in North Georgia named Jay Jarvis. Jarvis worked for 32 years in the crime lab of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation and now runs a consulting agency called ARMA Forensics. Jarvis describes the handgun that fired the fatal bullet.
The Smith & Wesson Model 638 is a five-shot 38 special. It differs from the Model 38 in that the 638 has a stainless steel cylinder, whereas the Model 38 was all aluminum.
One unusual feature of this revolver is the hammer. In gun parlance, it's shrouded. That is, it's almost covered except for about 1/8 of an inch sticking up through the cover. You use that tiny little piece of the hammer to cock the weapon. For those who don't know how guns work, it's way easier to fire a gun when it's cocked. Just jarring the trigger of a cocked weapon can set it off. But if the gun isn't cocked, you have to exert some pressure to fire a shot. Some guns have heavier trigger pulls than others. The 12-pound trigger pull of MacIver's gun makes it unlikely that you'll fire by accident when the weapon is not cocked. Unlikely, but not impossible. Jarvis talked to me about why MacIver's gun has a shrouded hammer.
The reason it was created was so you could kind of keep it in your pocket, and when you went to draw it out, the hammer spur wouldn't get snagged on your clothes. It's also become kind of popular because a woman, for example, could keep it in her purse. And because there is no exposed hammer, you could actually fire it inside the purse. I mean, you could reach your hand in there and fire it through the outside of the purse. If you were in a situation where you had to get a shot off in a hurry, you wouldn't even have to pull it out.
You can bet the prosecution will bring in somebody like Jarvis to talk about what's involved in firing the gun when it isn't cocked.
So typically in a five-shot like this from Smith & Wesson, I would expect the single action or the trigger pull where the hammer was already cocked to be somewhere in the 3 to 5 pound range, whereas the double action would be in the 10 to 12 pound range.
By the way, We've posted a photo of the weapon on ajcbreakdown.com and in our Breakdown Facebook group. If you're not a member, please join. In an interview with the AJC shortly after the shooting, MacIver told us he didn't know whether the gun was cocked or not. He's being asked the question by my former colleague, Craig Schneider.
Right, and you didn't know, Tex, whether or not it was cocked that day, right?
No, I hadn't touched it in a long time.
Did you hear that? Tex said, no, I hadn't touched it in a long time. Which means the prosecution can reasonably speculate that the gun was not cocked and therefore required 12 pounds of pressure to fire. So the state has that going for it. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Remember the Ross Harris hot car murder case? Many observers didn't think the state ever proved that Harris intended to leave his son to die in a hot SUV. But what the state did do was show Harris to be such a sleazy, awful person that the jury had little problem finding him guilty. Here's Marietta defense attorney Ashley Merchant on the Harris connection.
I think that Fulton County DA's office is definitely going to try to do a full character assassination on MacIver at trial, just like in Ross Harris, where the Cobb County DA's office tried to prove and did prove in the eyes of the jury. I mean, I certainly don't agree that they proved malice, but the jury did. And most of why the jury did was because of all this extra evidence, you know, extraneous evidence of character that was admitted to try and prove motive. And the jury at the end of that trial, at the end of Ross Harris, thought that he was a monster and thought that he wanted his child dead because of all the awful things that they heard. And I think we're going to see a very similar case with Tex MacIver, because otherwise it's a toss-up, you know? I mean, is it an accident? Was it reckless? Was it malice? It's kind of a toss-up. So you need something that's going to tilt the scale towards the state. And what they've got is they've got evidence of financial motivation. And so to prove that, they can bring in all this other stuff that, taken outside of this case, may not mean anything.
So how does the prosecution go about denigrating MacIver's character? Well, he kind of did that for them. Here's a closer look at the self-assassination MacIver performed after his arrest. Yes, he told Danny Jo Carter that she should tell police she wasn't in the SUV the night of the killing, even though Danny Jo was driving, which would have meant Tex was driving, which would have meant no one was in the back seat to fire the shot that killed Diane. In addition, staff at Emory Hospital ER saw the three of them drive up in the Ford Expedition. MacIver later left a phone message with Danny Joe's husband. He said if Danny Jo kept talking to the police, she'd put him in prison. But that wasn't enough. He then asked Danny Joe's husband to delete the message. Of course, the DA recovered the message and is using it now against MacIver. You can imagine the reaction in Atlanta to the report that Tex decided to arm himself after seeing people he thought were Black Lives Matter protesters. Or maybe they were carjackers. Some people were offended. Many people were infuriated. So Tex asked his spokesman, Bill Crane, to retract the Black Lives Matter comment. MacIver is charged with 3 counts of influencing a witness, which is a felony, for these 3 alleged incidents. Next in the hit parade, MacIver called attorney Steve Maples to the hospital the night of the shooting. Witnesses said Maples had a legal pad. The two men were huddling, seeming to be putting together a game plan. MacIver was heard asking, "What do I say? What do I do?" And finally, and perhaps most damning, MacIver began an inventory of Diane's belongings days after her death. He then organized 3 auctions. MacIver says he had to stage the auctions because Diane left large sums of money to friends and employees. He needed to sell her stuff to fund those bequests, he said. But here's what we learned during last week's hearing. Listen to Clint Rucker.
Now, the evidence is going to be that after the estate sale, hundreds of thousands of dollars were collected. And to this day, as we sit here right now, not one person has been paid that was bequeathed money from Diane Guyver's will.
That gets the breakdown, wow, don't you think? Wow. And finally, the motive for the murder. If indeed this was a murder. Tex and Diane had a lot of money. In the end, however, Diane had a lot of money and Tex was in trouble. Tex's law firm income had been steadily decreasing. He was, after all, 74 years old at the time of the shooting and was not as active in the firm as he once was. Here's what he told us.
Oh, I'm what's called an income partner. I'm not an equity partner. I want to take a little more time off and just see with Diane.
Equity partners have a stake in the firm's ownership and share its profits. Income partners are typically paid a salary. These can be younger lawyers who haven't made partner, lawyers who are phasing out their careers, or, as one legal recruiting firm, BCG, describes on its website, attorneys who are former equity partners but are no longer cutting it. So we know through financial documents that MacIver's income, when he was an equity partner about a decade ago, topped $600,000 a year. In 2016, the year of the fatal shooting, his income had dropped below $200,000. Still, not bad for a 74-year-old guy, right? But remember, MacIver had a ranch outside Atlanta. It had longhorn steers, horses, employees. In fact, MacIver had to pay $15,000 to $20,000 a month, or more than $200,000 a year, just for the upkeep. And Diane had lent Tex $350,000 in 2011 to build a Western-style saloon and a guest house at the ranch. During the hearing, Rucker said Tex had pledged his interest in the ranch as security for that loan, and there was a clause that allowed Diane to call in the loan. If Diane foreclosed on Tex's interest in the ranch, Rucker said, in her new will, she could have disposed of it however she wished. That's the new will that nobody has seen. I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about this at trial, and frankly, we need to. All in all, the state's theory is still a little unsatisfying. Something else came up during that pretrial hearing. The prosecution filed a sweeping motion with a long list of hearsay testimony that the state wants to admit. These are all statements that Diane apparently made to friends, co-workers, even the doctor who tried to save her life. I can't tell you whether the jury will hear all of this. Don't worry, you'll hear it. There's some damaging stuff here, like what Diane is said to have told Elaine Williams, a paralegal at the company she worked for. Quote, "My greatest fear is not having enough money to live the lifestyle that I'm accustomed to," unquote. And, quote, "I'm tired of carrying Tex," unquote. And what she said to co-worker Ken Rickert, quote, "Tex's salary was reduced, and I don't know what he's going to do," unquote. There's also a trove of emails between Tex and Diane. A sampling? Tex to Diane in June 2016, 3 months before she died. Quote, "I am seriously trying to reduce my monthly expenses. Debt is my biggest obstacle right now. Plan on hitting the lotto sometime this week," unquote. Diane back to Tex, quote, "Make sure you read Javier's job description. That is your next life chapter. Save you moolah," unquote. Okay, Javier is the guy who kept up the MacIver's ranch, took care of the horses and the longhorns and so forth. It's hard to know the tone of these emails, but it sounds kind of playful to me. Here's Tex's response. Quote, "Guess it's back to gigoloing," unquote. No doubt, some of these exchanges raise questions. So that's what we've been able to glean from pretrial hearings and hundreds of pages of filings. But would the disagreement over the ranch provide a motive for murder? I don't know. The defense, of course, says that's ridiculous. Here's MacIver's lawyer, Bruce Harvey, blasting the entire prosecution case.
It's way overcharged. There is no substantive reason. There's no factual reason. There's no emotional reason. There's no reason at all that this should be elevated from anything other than an accidental, unintentional act to an intentional act. And there's not one single fact, in this case that would justify that. It is purely a political act.
I asked Harvey what he meant by political act. He declined to elaborate. We'll go further into what I think he's talking about in the next episode.
the idea that there is any motive, financial or otherwise, behind an accidental and unintentional shooting is the worst type of, to quote a current politician, fake news that you'll ever hear.
We'll be right back.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
So let's talk about the defense. In spite of the hand grenades MacGyver has thrown into his own defense, there's a lot to work with here. First, look at the financial circumstances as a defense, not a motive. Diane made far more money than Tex did. Losing her meant losing someone who earned more than twice what Tex brought in. Why do that? There's also been a lot of talk about a new will that would have essentially cut Tex out of the money. But look, Tex was 74 years old and Diane was 64. The chances were very good that Tex wouldn't be around for whatever Diane's will would say. I hate to put it in such base and blunt terms, but there it is. Beyond finances, we have the couple, Tex and Diane themselves. Everyone we've talked to who were close to these two, everyone, says Tex was smitten with Diane.
I thought they were an outstanding couple for a lot of reasons, not just that I think the chemistry between them was great. They had so much in common. They had all the right ingredients for a good friendship.
That's Linda Winkler, a neighbor of the couple in the Buckhead condo. Don't forget about what Danny Joe told police shortly after Diane died at Emory University Hospital.
He absolutely worships her. Absolutely. I get jealous of them sometimes because they're more like lovebirds than right. My husband and I.
And when asked by Atlanta homicide detective Darren Smith at that time, Danny Joe said she was certain this was not murder.
Do you have any reason to believe that it was an accident or intentional?
There is not a doubt in my mind that it was completely one of the most horrible accidents that I've know about.
I expect the prosecution will object to this coming in, so we don't know for sure whether she'll be allowed to say that on the stand. After all, whether this was an accident is ultimately a determination for the jury to make. There was also the testimony of Dr. Susan Hardy, the ER surgeon who treated Diane that night at Emory. She said, as you may recall, that Diane told her the shooting was an accident. Will the jury hear that? It appears so. The prosecution filed a motion last week indicating they expect Dr. Hardy's testimony to come in.
It's a dying declaration.
That's Marietta defense lawyer Ashley Merchant.
Hearsay is when there's a statement that's made by someone outside of court and that person's not in court. So obviously Diane's not going to come to testify at court. So she's made this out-of-court statement. They want to admit it because it's helpful to the defense. The exceptions are things that make it so reliable that we're not concerned that it's hearsay. So one of those is what's called a dying declaration. And basically the law is saying that we think something that someone says when they're dying is so reliable that we're not concerned that it's hearsay. We think legally that when people are getting ready to die, they just don't lie, that they say the truth. I think it means that when she's dying, she doesn't want him to be charged. She doesn't want anybody to prosecute him because she thinks that it had to have been an accident. And that's why I think it's powerful for the defense, because it's her speaking to the jury. I mean, it's really the only time they're going to hear anything from her.
I'm sure the prosecution will argue that Diane really didn't know for sure that her shooting was accidental. As she lay dying, how could she be certain that Tex hadn't wanted to kill her? Well, it certainly appears she had no reason to believe that. Conversely, don't forget what Dr. Hardy asked Diane before she put her under. Would you like to see your husband? The doctor asked. Diane's response? No. Just as the prosecution will talk a lot about guns, so will the defense. They'll present their own gun experts. I don't know what their experts will say, but here's what our guy says.
Because the way this thing is designed, because the hammer is shrouded,
it may have been very difficult in the dark to know when the gun was handed to him, for example, whether it was already cocked or not.
That's Jay Jarvis, the longtime GBI firearms expert.
Now, of course, I don't know whether it was, and I don't know that anybody would ever know, but it's not immediately obvious when you look at a gun like this whether or not the hammer's cocked or not, especially in a low-light situation. The only way you can really tell would be to look straight down into the cutout in the shroud and see where the position of the hammer spur is. So conceivably, you know, it wouldn't have been a wise thing to do to have the gun stored in a console with the hammer already cocked, but conceivably, when it was handed back to him, it may have been cocked, or if he had a certain amount of fear because of the location they were in, he may have cocked the gun, but I would tend to doubt that he would cock the gun unless he really thought that they were in immediate danger.
Can you accidentally pull the trigger of an uncocked 38?
It can happen. There's no question about that. This whole scenario of there being a traffic jam on the downtown connector, which the two ladies in the front then make a decision, we're going to get off the interstate and try to take Surface Street. So this whole route that they took was totally unplanned. So to think that he created a scenario where he was going to accidentally shoot her, number one, he would not have known at the beginning of the trip that they were going to be taken through this neighborhood. I would think if he was going to try to shoot it in the car that he would have already had the gun back there with him. That's a little suspicious to me.
Jarvis also wonders why you'd shoot someone through a car seat.
If you want to try to shoot somebody in a vehicle, trying to shoot them through what I would call an intermediate target, in this case would be the seat back of the car, you run the risk of the bullet. Well, number one, you can't get a good view as to where the person's vital organs are, and there's always a possibility that the bullet could be deflected as it goes through the seat material. All that I think I'd be willing to say is that I think this was just a very, very unfortunate and tragic accident, and for somebody to try to make something more out of it, I think is a stretch.
Jarvis also poses a question that is likely haunting the prosecution.
The other interesting thing to me was the fact that if you wanted to stage an accidental shooting, why not do it right as they hand you the gun, fumble with it or something like that, and then have it go off, as opposed to waiting till they drive 6 or 7 miles out of the area for the so-called accident to happen.
Here's Matt Malier from Sharpshooters.
Under stress, they say that your average trigger pull weight goes up to 25 foot-pounds energy, which is more than enough to pull any trigger.
Now, this is a bit more exotic, and I don't know what role it might play in the defense. Tex also suffers from a sleep disorder known as parasomnia. The National Sleep Foundation says parasomnia is a thing. It cites sleep-related eating disorders, sleepwalking, sleep aggression, and yes, sexsomnia, the act of having sex while sleeping. All of these are parasomnias. Okay, take that or leave it. But there is a parasomnia that might be relevant to this case. The foundation says, and I quote, "There are parasomnias that occur when a person has abrupt, partial awakenings. Sleep-related hallucinations may occur as a person is waking up," unquote. It doesn't say whether sleeping sex is better than waking sex, by the way. That wraps up the potential legal strategies and hurdles faced by both sides. As we've said many times before, we only know a fraction of what the prosecution knows. But soon enough, all will be revealed. Next, on Breakdown.
So we'll be asking our witnesses, where was the gun? How far was it from the back seat? Where was it aimed? Was it in the bag? Those are all facts. Sure. Nobody's going to contest that we can put those facts in evidence. You know, and then we're going to ask the jury to draw a conclusion. Obviously, it was an accident.
Breakdown is reported and narrated by Bill Rankin, produced by Richard Hallix. Sound design by Chris Basta of Bare Knuckles Creative in Atlanta. Original music composed and performed by Bo Emerson, Billy Guin, and Chris Basta. Special thanks to Bert Roten, who lit the fire that became Breakdown. Special thanks as well to the AJC's editor-in-chief and podcaster, Kevin Riley, to Pete Corson, Monica Richardson, Mark Wallagore, and all the fine folks at the Journal Constitution, plus Chris Basta and Chris Nicholson, a.k.a. C1 and C2, Buddy Hall, Josh Gaynor, and our good friends at WSB-TV and radio.
Hello, this is a collect call from
Tex MacIver,
an inmate at
Fulton County Jail.
The AJC's trusted veteran political voices, Greg Bluestein, Patricia Murphy, Tia Mitchell, and Bill Nigut, are the essential source for Georgia politics. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Politically Georgia. Sign up for the newsletter, download the podcast, subscribe to the AJC.
Our journalists at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution are working around the clock to keep you updated on all the developments surrounding the Trump indictment. Now the AJC is putting all of our coverage in one place with our new Trump 19 newsletter. Every Wednesday, you'll have our latest coverage and analysis on this historic case in your inbox. So sign up for free today at ajc.com/indictment newsletter. That's all one word. ajc.com/indictment newsletter.